Welcome to Norse Mythology, the unofficial guide. It's unofficial because I'm neither a credentialed academic nor a time-traveling medieval Norse pagan, but I deal with this material directly from the sources, interpreted through the lens of the experts and their opinions. If you're looking for depth and detail in a simple and accessible way, then you're in the right place. At Christmas time, the wild huntsman leads his procession through the air at midnight. He is preceded by an old man who warns the people of the danger. Then comes a woman, on a white horse, with neither a saddle nor a bridle. On her right side is the wild huntsman, riding on a fiery horse. Behind them are their followers, with howling dogs and shouting loudly. It is said that a peasant was returning home from town at midnight, when he suddenly heard hunting cries behind him. Turning around, he saw an old man, who shouted to him to be careful. The peasant threw himself down, with his face to the ground, and the procession passed by him without incident. Another time, a tradesman was walking through a forest by night. Suddenly he heard barking dogs and an unusual commotion in the woods. He threw himself down, with his face to the ground. Before the procession flew past him, he curiously looked up, and from that hour onward, he was insane. These stories were collected in Bohemia in 1863 and represent a tiny slice of what appears all across Europe as wild hunt folklore. But as common as the wild hunt is, its details vary widely by location. Sometimes a demon chases a wild procession of damned souls. Sometimes a ghostly huntsman leads a team in search of animal prey. Sometimes the hunt is led by a woman. Sometimes the leader of the hunt will give food or money to a passerby, but other times they will be given only a rotten chunk of animal flesh or will even be snatched up by the hunter and carried away to oblivion. In Germanic-speaking areas, we find a particular commonality among many stories of this terrifying midnight forest procession of otherworldly horrors, which is that it is often led by Odin. When I decided to write an episode about Odin, I realized after I'd taken about 20 pages worth of notes that I was going to have to slim some things down and make some decisions about where to focus. I will barely be able to cover a fraction of what there is to say about Odin in this episode, so for now, I want to try and paint a picture of where the chief of the Norse gods probably came from, and how he fits into the Norse religious framework as a hunter of souls. The two main brushes I'll be using to paint that picture are linguistic reconstruction, care of an essay by Anatoly Lieberman, and source material evidence, care of Jens-Peter Schutt. But before we begin reaching back into the darkness of forgotten history, let's recap who Odin is. From the Prose Edda, we learn that Odin is the chief of the gods. He's the grandson of two out of the three primordial beings that existed before the world was, both of Ymir, the progenitor of the Hrimthursar, often called frost giants, and of Buri, the progenitor of the Æsir clan. The third primordial being, of course, was a cow. Though Odin may not be part bovine, he is, like many of the gods, unquestionably of Jotunkin. Odin and his two brothers, Vili and Ve, ultimately killed Ymir and created the earth from various parts of his body. They also created humans out of driftwood they happened to find washed up on land. In the poem Völuspá, of course, mankind's co-creators alongside Odin are named as Hunir and Lothar, rather than Vili and Ve. And although there are some discrepancies that do come down to us about stories involving Odin from different sources, he also has some traits that always remain constant. Foremost among these is that he only has one eye, which is even attested by archaeological finds as far away as England, where the Anglo-Saxon pagans referred to him dialectically as both Woden and Wedden, the eponym that eventually found its way into the word Wednesday, the day of Wedden. The Prose Edda tells us, and Völuspá seems to corroborate, that Odin once sacrificed an eye for a drink from Mimir's well, a spring filled with drinkable wisdom and knowledge. It's one of many instances where Odin has gone to extreme lengths to acquire knowledge, but it also fits a fascinating theme we see recurring time and time again in the source material dealing with disfigurement and defects. Odin has one eye, Tyr has one hand, Thor has a permanent head wound from his battle with Hrungnir. Heimdallr may or may not be missing an ear. Höðr, who we haven't discussed yet, is blind. Mjolnir's handle is defectively short. One of Thor's goats is lame, and so is an elf character that we haven't talked about yet, named Völundr. Lieberman asserts that, quote, Ásgarðr presents a clear case of ritual mutilation, a series of traits whose meaning had been forgotten long before the myths acquired the form familiar to us from Saxo, Snorri, and partly the sagas, end quote. Physical ailments, he notes, appear to show up as marks of special destiny in Norse tales. It seems that everybody and everything had to pay the highest price of disfigurement for being able to perform a unique duty, or for a great achievement. Odin is married to the goddess Frigg, whose name means beloved, and who, like Odin himself, is attested in various forms all across the Germanic-speaking world, where Odin as Wedin gives us Wednesday, Frigg as the Anglo-Saxon Frigg gives us Friday. Odin's children, or at least the gods who we can say with the most confidence are his sons, even if they aren't all sons of the same mother, are Thor, Baldur, Hodr, Vidar, and Vali, but there are very probably others. Even if you aren't familiar with all of these names just yet, don't worry, they'll all get their time to shine in future episodes. Apart from his missing eye, Odin is most commonly described as an older man wearing a dark blue cloak and a large or wide-brimmed hat, sometimes also tall and sporting a gray beard. He owns a golden arm ring called Draupnir that magically produces 8 more golden rings of equal weight every 9 nights, as well as a spear called Gungnir that has runes carved on the tip and can't be stopped in a thrust. From his throne called Hlidskjolf, he's able to look out over the world and observe events, but because he's not omniscient, he relies upon 2 ravens named Hugin and Munin, upon whom he has bestowed the power of speech to travel the world and bring news back to him. Hugin and Munin roughly translate to mind and memory, and Odin worries about losing both. In the poem Grimnismal, he famously tells us in stanza 20, quote, Hugin and Munin fly every day over the vast stretching world. I fear for Hugin that he will not come back, yet I tremble more for Munin, end quote. While at home, Odin keeps 2 wolves named Geri and Freki, whose names both indicate something like ravenousness or greediness. And this weapon-magnificent father of armies feeds those wolves, we are told in Grimnismal 19, which I think is probably supposed to sound ominous. However, he subsists entirely on wine himself. On the subject of his relationship to animals, Odin is the owner of the 8-legged horse Sleipnir, who we are told is the best horse among all gods and men. He can run across the sea and the sky and is extremely fast. Interestingly, horse riding isn't something we actually see very often among the gods in the Scandinavian tradition. Odin is canonically a horse rider. Apart from that, Thor gives a horse to his son Magni, and Snorri puts Heimdallr on a horse called Gulltop at one point. But for the most part, we typically see the gods, including Thor, being transported by other means, either being pulled by chariots or riding boars, even just flying or walking. It's unclear whether this trend would have held true in other related Germanic traditions, though. It's worth noting that the second Merseburg charm from Germany places its versions of both Odin and Baldur on horses riding through a holt. Odin often wanders the world in disguise on his perpetual quest to acquire knowledge. Sometimes he's completely unrecognizable, and other times he seems to make no effort at all to change his appearance, and it's almost a little silly that the people he encounters don't recognize him. In many stories, we are never told explicitly by the narrator that a certain character is supposed to be Odin. Instead, we are given a description of an old man with one eye and a wide-brimmed hat, and are expected to understand implicitly who this man is. As Odin travels the world experiencing different events, he picks up names. In fact, scholars have been able to identify over 200 unique names for Odin, many of which have to do with magic, war, and poetry. Taken together, they reveal an extremely complex character. The full list includes names that seem contradictory at face value, such as both deceiver and truthful. He can be called evildoer, but also protector. It seems that most of what Odin does is done with purpose, regardless of whether it earns him a positive or a negative name. And what looks to be his primary purpose, apart from the acquisition of knowledge, is gathering souls to fight alongside him against the Jotnar in the final world-ending Battle of Ragnarok. This brings us to what is, perhaps, the most religiously significant aspect of Odin, the spear. And not just his personal spear, but the spear in general turns out to be one of our most important keys to understanding who worshipped Odin during the pagan period and how that worship was performed. In Schutt's profile on Odin, he reminds us that while it can be argued that Odin was the, quote, mightiest god in the Scandinavian pantheon, nothing suggests he was ever the most venerated, end quote. And as a point of further clarification, he notes that nothing suggests that Odin was ever a god of importance to the daily life of common people. In contrast with Thor, for example, whose name found its way into myriad Norse personal names, such as Thorbjorn, Thorstein, and Hafthor, and whose iconic weapon was worn as a pendant by people all over Scandinavia, there's actually only one confirmed record of a female personal name incorporating Odin, and there is no archaeological evidence of clearly Odinic jewelry commonly worn by the average person. That one name, by the way, is Odindis, which means Lady of Odin, and it's found on a single runestone from Vestmanland, Sweden. Schutt suggests that Odin's demonic character, which we'll come back to, could have made naming a child after him a kind of a societal taboo. Where we do find evidence for the Odinic cult is among warbands and nobility, which fits the fact that places named after Odin seem to be concentrated around seats of power in ancient Scandinavia, specifically in Denmark and in southern and eastern Sweden. He is also often named as the ancestor of royal and noble families. Most prominently, the saga of the Volsungs portrays him as the forefather of the Jarls of Lade and of the Volsung dynasty, making him a direct ancestor of Sigurdr the Dragonslayer. Even among the Christian-era Anglo-Saxon royal genealogies recorded between the 8th and 10th centuries, Anglo-Saxon kings trace their ancestry back to Woden, typically listing themselves as exactly 9, there's that number again, generations removed from him. Where we find no place names related to Odin at all is in Iceland, a country without kings and lacking in warrior bands, but which produced the vast majority of our mythological source material about Odin. Schutt believes that he must have been worshipped in Iceland to some degree, but it would have been mostly by poets and warriors with an international outlook, people who had visited kings in Scandinavia and England, not by ordinary farmers. And this would help explain why in Harbarðsljóð stanza 24, Odin taunts Thor by stating that he owns the nobles who fall in battle, and that Thor gets the race of slaves. Getting back to the spear, I mentioned that Odin's primary purpose is to gather souls to fight alongside him at Ragnarok, because, as we learn in the 10th century skaldic poem Eriksmál, quote, it cannot be known for certain when the gray wolf will attack the home of the gods, end quote. And so, maybe above all else, Odin is the god of dead warriors. The prose Edda tells us that being received into Odin's hall, Valhöll, and joining his supernatural army in the afterlife is an event reserved for those who die in battle. But Schutt notes that the true pre-Christian story is probably more complex than this. What seems more probable, he says, is that any king who is ritually initiated to Odin is supposed to go to Valhöll, and that the idea of kings being descended from Odin may actually have been created through initiation rituals, which a person went through before taking on the role of king. We also have attestations of warriors who were not kings and who did not fall in battle still going to Valhöll. In the saga of the Volsungs, the character Sinfjotli is poisoned to death by a woman, and his body is ferried away personally by Odin. In the poem Eriksmál, he is once again attested as being there in Valhöll. The key to how a person might enter Valhöll without dying in battle may actually lie in Snorri's euhemerized history of the gods in Ynglingasaga. In this account, Odin himself dies of sickness, not in battle, and just before death, he, quote, marked himself with the point of a spear, end quote, and then declared himself the owner of all men who fell in battle and claimed that he was about to depart for the home of the gods. Later on, when another god described as human, Njörður, also dies of illness, he, quote, marked himself for Odin, end quote, and we assume that this resulted in him also going to Valhöll. The potential takeaway here is that there may have been a ritual employed by certain members of society that would allow them to join Odin in the afterlife if they pierced themselves in some way with a spear before death, thus dedicating themselves to Odin. And it is almost unquestionably true that a spear is used to dedicate a person to Odin. In Sturbjarnar Þóttr Svíakappa, the character Eric throws a spear over the army of the Danes and shouts, "I give you all to Odin." Then, in Eyrbyggjasaga, we see the character Steinþór throw a spear over an army for good luck, according to, quote, ancient custom, which is all reminiscent of Völuspá's description of the Æsir-Vanir War, which begins with Odin throwing a spear at the opposing army. The idea appears to be that in war, you are trying to send your enemies to Odin, which resembles a form of human sacrifice. Schutt goes so far as to suggest that Snorri's phrase, die in battle, is actually symbolic, not only for literal dying in battle, but also for any kind of initiation or dedicatory ritual that gives a person to Odin. It's worth noting that Odin will sometimes see to it himself that his chosen heroes die in battle. For example, the hero Sigmundur, from the Saga of the Volsungs, is helped by Odin throughout his entire career, and then is personally killed by him on the battlefield. In Saxo Grammaticus's Danish history Gesta Danorum, Odin grants King Harald Wartooth an invulnerability to steel, and in return, Harald promises that Odin will have the souls of the people he kills. Later on, Odin takes the form of Harald's chariot driver in battle, pushes him off the chariot, and beats him to death with his own mace, since he can't be stabbed with steel. The spear also shows up in the motif of Odin being the god of the hanged. In Havamal stanza 138, Odin tells us that he hung on a windswept tree for 9 long nights, wounded with a spear, sacrificing himself to himself. And the result of this endeavor is that he obtains the runes. It's an episode we actually see mirrored in both Gautrek's saga and also in Gesta Danorum, where we get two different versions of a story in which a character named Starkother kills a king named Vikar. In the saga, there is a point where a human sacrifice is required by Odin in order for a ship to obtain a fair wind. Lots are cast to determine who should be sacrificed, and the lot falls upon King Vikar, which kind of shakes everybody up. Nobody wants to actually sacrifice their king, and so they decide to hold a mock sacrifice instead. They create a fake gallows out of an extremely low-hanging pine branch, and a fake noose out of some animal intestines, and to top it all off, a fake spear made out of a reed stalk. Starkother puts the noose around Vikar's neck and proclaims, "Now I give you to Odin," and stabs at him with the reed stalk. As soon as he does, the stalk transforms into a real spear and pierces the king. The noose becomes real as well, and the pine branch shoots high up into the tree, hanging the king. The account is less magical than this in Saxo's version, but the king is still likewise both hung and stabbed as part of the event. Human sacrifice, and especially death by hanging, is actually a repeatedly attested part of the Odinic cult, stretching all the way back to Roman times. There is certainly debate about how true or biased some of these third-party accounts are, and about how often human sacrifice would have been performed if it was, but it's worth noting that the claims about human sacrifices do fall relatively well in line with each other, and also with some Scandinavian material in a pretty consistent way. In the 1st century AD, the Roman author Tacitus wrote that the continental Germanic people chiefly worship Mercury. For various reasons, we typically accept that when Tacitus says Mercury here, he is actually referring to an ancient version of Odin, who would probably have been known as Wodanaz among Germanic-speaking people at the time. Tacitus tells us that, quote, "to him, on certain stated days, it is lawful to offer even human victims," end quote. In the 11th century, a German Christian named Adam of Bremen wrote a supposedly second-hand account of worship that occurred at a pagan temple in Uppsala, Sweden, and also about a festival held there every 9 years. In describing Odin's role, Adam tells us that, quote, "Wotan, that is, the furious, carries on war and imparts to man strength against his enemies," end quote. Fascinatingly, Adam gives us an etymology of Odin's name here that is relatively correct and seems to relate the meaning of that name to warfare. He goes on to explain that libations are poured out to certain idols at the temple under different circumstances. Quote, "If plague and famine threaten, a libation is poured to the idol Thor. If war, to Wotan. If marriages are to be celebrated, to Freyko," end quote. We assume Freyko here is a reference to Freyr. It gets darker, though. At the 9-year festival, sacrifices are made. As Adam puts it, quote, The sacrifice is of this nature. Of every living thing that is male, they offer 9 heads, with the blood of which it is customary to placate gods of this sort. The bodies they hang in the sacred grove that adjoins the temple. Now, this grove is so sacred in the eyes of the heathen that each and every tree in it is believed divine because of the death or putrefaction of the victims. Even dogs and horses hang there, with men. A Christian, 72 years old, told me that he had seen their bodies suspended promiscuously. Furthermore, the incantations customarily chanted in the ritual of a sacrifice of this kind are manifold and unseemly. Therefore, it is better to keep silence about them. End quote. Moving away from promiscuous death and putrefaction for a moment, one of the more puzzling aspects of Odin is his relationship to another Aesir god named Oðr, who is the husband of the goddess Freyja. Right off the bat, we notice that Odin and Oðr sound remarkably similar. And just as Odin spends much of his time wandering the earth in disguise, we are told in the prose Edda that Oðr went off on long travels, leaving Freyja behind to weep tears of red gold. She has also adopted various names while traveling among strange peoples searching for her husband. This, combined with the fact that Freyja is actually attested as Odin's mistress in a few scattered instances, makes us start to wonder if there might be some kind of common origin shared between Odin and Oðr. But there are more reasons we might want to try and decipher Odin's origins. For instance, as Lieberman notes, the Norse pantheon doesn't fall exactly in line with what we might expect when compared to other Indo-European pantheons. As a side note, I don't really like using the word pantheon in a Norse context because it feels like it doesn't really describe the situation very well, but it's the word Lieberman uses here, so we'll go with it for now. Follow me down this rabbit hole for a second. The god Tyr's name evolved from Tiwaz in the older Proto-Germanic language, which itself evolved from the Proto-Indo-European word Deivos, a word from around 5,000 years ago meaning god, and built from a root that meant bright sky. Among other Indo-European groups, that same word as a name also evolved into Zeus, and was combined with the ancient word for father to eventually yield Jupiter as well. There are more Indo-European cultures than just these, of course, but the Greeks and Romans are two that most people will be somewhat familiar with, which is why I use them for comparison a lot on this show. The ancient Sky Father seems to have been the most prominent Proto-Indo-European deity, but while his name was inherited by Tyr, and while a thundering aspect common to both of the chief gods Zeus and Jupiter was inherited by Thor, it is neither Tyr nor Thor who occupies the position of chief god in the Norse context. It is Odin. On top of this, when we examine the distribution of locations that were historically named after various gods, the evidence seems to show a possible migration of Odin worship beginning in more southern Germanic areas and moving up into Scandinavia over time, which all makes us start to wonder whether or not Odin may have actually supplanted someone else as chief god at some point in time before the Viking Age began. Along with this, Schutt suggests that there is actually evidence that an earlier stage of Germanic mythology may have portrayed a god of the Thor type as being the one involved in killing the primordial antagonist, rather than Odin, as the story was recorded in the prose Edda. Lieberman leans heavily into the idea that Odin is a later recipient of the status of chief god, and believes it can be shown through linguistics, but that doesn't mean the origins of Odin himself are new. Using the name Woden to refer to Odinic gods across all of Germanic-speaking territory, Lieberman notes that, quote, Woden's distant predecessor existed long before the formation of the Indo-European pantheon, and did not have a human shape. There was no individual divinity, but rather a host of frightening wild hunters. With time, Odin became its leader, end quote. But evolution is rarely straightforward. As concepts morph over time, various branches develop. Some of those branches die off, and some continue in different forms. It's why the words Tyr, Zeus, and even Spanish Dios all exist, are all similar, but are also all very different. Because evolution is messy, Lieberman adds his voice to the pool of scholars who believe that Odin and Freya's husband Oðr are in some way related, but are not the same. In Lieberman's view, both characters probably emerged independently out of the Wild Hunt, but it so happened to be Odin who was eventually elevated to the role of chief god. To be clear, Lieberman's essay is bold. It combines linguistic techniques with modern folklore analysis to tell a fascinating story, and I wish I had hours to spend going through it point by point with you, discussing the pieces I think make sense, as well as the pieces I think are a reach. But the overall story goes like this. Long ago, ancient belief held that, on occasion, a procession of dead bodies would fly through the air or ride on horseback. In the Germanic-speaking world, this supernatural wild hunt was called Woth, with various grammatical declensions attached as necessary. Woth was a collective noun related to fury and frenzy, and could be used to refer to both the group of wild hunters as well as to their leader. That leader was an ancient demon of death, inseparable from his horse, so much so that he was often conceptualized as theriomorphic, half man, half horse. And Lieberman believes that a version of this idea was preserved in the myth about the birth of Odin's horse Sleipnir, who had an anthropomorphic mother in Loki and an equine father in Svadilfari. In a way, he remains half man, half horse. Such an image would have been terrible and frightening, and it earned the wild hunter one of his many names, Ygr, meaning exactly that, terrible and frightening. It's a name that would accompany this character on into modern times. But at some point, a suffix denoting leadership was added to his name. Woth became Wothanaz, and by the time Tacitus began writing about West Germanic mythology, he had become an anthropomorphic deity surrounded by other gods, all of whom could be compared with the gods of the Romans. By the age of skaldic poetry, Wothanaz had become Odin, the supreme deity of the Æsir and the patron of both kings and skalds. Or so goes Lieberman's version of the story. Exactly how accurate his version is debatable. But the idea of Odin having origins in the Wild Hunt is not new. It was first proposed by Jacob Grimm of the Brothers Grimm back in the 1800s, and is still pretty well received today. And even though Odin was eventually ascribed a kingly status, and even though the introduction of Christianity effectively halted the Odinic cult in its tracks, the Wild Hunt continued. Centuries later, Christians in England would be haunted by the following event, recording it in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle to be preserved forever. In my own translation, quote, "No man should think unworthily that we speak not the truth, for it was full known over all the land that as soon as Henry arrived on that Sunday when men sing Exsurge Quare, that soon thereafter many men saw and heard many hunters hunting. The hunters were dark, large and terrifying, and their hounds were all dark, broad-eyed and terrifying. And they rode on dark horses and on dark bucks. This was seen in the very deer fold in the town of Peterborough, and in all the woods from that selfsame town to Stamford. And the monks heard the horn blow that they blew in the night. Trustworthy men who kept watch in the night said this, that they thought that there might well have been about 20 or 30 hornblowers. This was seen and heard from when Henry arrived, all through the season of Lent and on until Easter." End quote. With that in mind, I would encourage everyone listening to take heed when you hear the horns blowing and the dogs barking deep in the woods at night. Get low and stay out of sight, lest Odin might catch you and whisk you away from that play button, preventing you from joining me again next time on Norse Mythology, the Unofficial Guide. Sources for this episode include, and by the way, I'm going to try my best at this German again, Die wilde Jagd bei Schwarzkostelest by Josef Wilge Grommen in Sagenbuch von Böhmen und Mähren, erste Teil, Sagen aus Böhmen, 1863. Germania by Publius Cornelius Tacitus, 1st century. Odin by Jens Peter Schutt in Pre-Christian Religions of the North, Volume 3, 2020. Odin's Path to Greatness by Anatoly Lieberman in In Prayer and Laughter, Essays on Medieval Scandinavian and Germanic Mythology, Literature and Culture, 2016. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, The History of the Archbishops of Hamburg-Bremen by Adam of Bremen, 10th century, translated by Francis Chan. The Poetic Edda, translated by Caroline Larrington, 2014, and the Prose Edda, translated by Anthony Falks, 1995.